I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Anthony Wright has been free for just 1 week after serving 25 years in a Pennsylvania prison for a brutal crime he did not commit. He was exonerated by a jury this month because of DNA evidence that showed he did not rape and murder 77-year-old Louise Talley living in the Tioga Nicetown section of Philadelphia back in 1991. At his first and second trial, Mr. Wright said the confession he signed was coerced, and he spent many years writing letters saying that he was innocent. The Innocence Project received one of those letters and got involved in the case. Anthony Wright joins us on Radio Times. And Anthony, nice to have you here with us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is one of his lawyers, Rebecca Lasher. She's with the Philadelphia law firm of Schneider, Harrison, Siegel, and Lewis. And Rebecca Lasher, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Happy to be here.
Now, some states give the wrongly convicted some form of compensation, but not Pennsylvania. And Marissa Bluestein wants to change that. She's legal director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. And Marissa Bluestein, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you with us. And Tyrone Wirtz had his sentence commuted after serving 36 years in a Pennsylvania prison. He now works with Temple University's Inside Out program, and he joins us to talk about reentry and ex-prisoners. And Tyrone Wirtz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Yes, thank you so much for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Anthony Wright, the question of the day is, how are you doing 1 week after serving 25 years in prison?
Wonderful. It's amazing.
What's been the most surprising, maybe shocking thing in the last 7 days for you?
Everything. I'm still taking it in every day. Everything.
We were talking before going on the air, and you said the first couple of days it took a long time to figure out how to sleep outside of prison. Get a good night's sleep, I guess.
Just trying to process everything. It's been a long time coming. It was a lot of sleepless nights before August the 23rd, the day of my release. I knew it was upon us. At least I believe that. You know, so I'm coping.
You're coping. I understand. And I do want to talk about that reentry process because it's got to be really difficult. Are you bitter, though? Are you bitter about those 25 years?
I wouldn't say that. And if I had to answer that question in one word, I'd say no, absolutely not.
And I think people would want to know why you weren't bitter.
You don't forget something like that happened to you. It changed my life in so many ways.
You were just 20 years old in 1991.
Just 20 years old, you know. So many people made so many sacrifices for me. My mother, being one, passed away 19 years ago.
Yeah.
Being a lifer, I was unable to attend her funeral.
That's got to have hurt.
Every time you see a photo of me, you're sharing a tear. It's for her. Thinking about her. She's been gone for 19 years. And finally, August the 23rd, she was able to rest in peace, knowing I made it.
I want to get back to you, Anthony, but let me turn to you, Rebecca Lasher, as one of his attorneys. Without DNA evidence, would Anthony Wright still be in prison? Do we know?
I don't think we do know, but it certainly helped, and it was the way we were able to get his convictions vacated at the PCRA stage, which was the first step in getting Anthony out.
Which was 2014, we should say, right?
His convictions were vacated in September of 2014.
So 2 years ago.
That's right.
And when we talk about the DNA evidence, what are we talking about here?
So in Anthony's case, there was a rape kit taken at the time of the autopsy, so back in October of 1991, and that rape kit was never tested. So testing was petitioned for under the PCRA, and that actually changed the law in Pennsylvania in Tony's case via the Innocence Project's work. And a decision in 2011 from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court allowed testing of the DNA even where there was a confession. And so the DA then finally agreed to test the rape kit.
Well, let me stop you there. Why? We're talking about something that happened in 1991. There was a rape kit that was used there was, what, DNA in that rape kit. Why wasn't it ever tested?
That's a question that came up at the 2016 trial and that has not been answered.
What does that say to you, Marissa Bluestein?
Well, I think that it says a few things. I mean, the evidence itself, there was some question about whether or not there was sperm present because they were using some kind of rudimentary test at the time, which we know has a lot of false positives and even false negatives. And the fact that it had to be retested after so many years that it was able to be done, of course, is the really important takeaway here. But I think what people probably don't know is when the judge allowed the testing, because the DA did finally agree to it, he said, well, if you want to go down fruitless exercises, that's up to you.
This is the DA talking.
This is the judge.
This is the judge talking.
The judge. Because the judge was so convinced that it would come back to confirm Anthony's guilt. And when it came back completely exonerating him, there was a whole change from the judge and the proceedings from that point.
Is it unusual to have something that wasn't tested? And also to think that a piece of evidence, such a critical piece of evidence, was there but never used to exonerate Anthony?
Right. I mean, you're talking about trials that happened before 1992, 93, 94, 95, when we really started using DNA. We don't know how many people are out there who could have this evidence. I mean, what I can say definitively is that here in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia in particular, dozens of people have wanted to have the DNA tested from their case, only to be told, I'm sorry, it's been destroyed, we don't have it. So we know that, who knows how many people among those dozens, even if only half. Those are people who should have been exonerated who will never have the chance to be. The reason Texas leads the country is because they preserve the evidence.
Wow.
We don't.
Let me turn to you, Tyrone. Just, you were, as I said, a guest a couple of years ago talking about reentry. And Anthony was talking about just, I mean, this is his first week out from prison. What are some of the thoughts, maybe from your own experience, about what it's like to reenter? Now, your story is different from Anthony's, obviously, and here's a guy who was exonerated.
Yes.
But what are your thoughts about those first couple of weeks of reentry?
Well, you know, I was just talking to Anthony. It's very, very difficult. And I don't think, you know, what's good for me is being able to sit next to Anthony and look into his eyes and we can relate. Because it's really difficult to relate to people who haven't had that experience of being incarcerated for so long to really get them to understand, you know, what is the impact transitioning from a really horrible situation out into a free society. As he said, he's still taking a lot of stuff in him. The same thing for me when I first came home. I really like the way that he's handling himself. You know, for me, I went to a halfway house, and I have to say it was the best thing to happen for me.
Because
really? The guy kind of like slowed things down and had a lot of pressure on me at the time. So his experience is different from mine. And the very nature of his is because he was an innocent man incarcerated. At least I can admit that I was guilty, that he was an innocent man. I can imagine what the psychological impact that is on him.
Well, I'm thinking about the highs, obviously, but then the lows. When you think about what was lost in those 25 years and in a sense, what you're owed.
Yeah. I mean, I almost shed a tear myself. I'm just hearing Anthony talk because it's the same thing with my mother and father. My parents passed when I was inside and I was unable to attend their funeral. And, you know, when you ask people, why do you want to come home? I came up North Philadelphia. I did some things. I really wanted my parents to see me outside of the prison wall and, you know, the man that they raised me really to be. And they never got that experience. But, you know, so there are these highs, these lows. You know, I had some psychological trauma since I've been home, you know, my first came home. Just by, you know, being incarcerated for so long and, you know, growing up with people inside and then leaving. So,
I mean, you need support. You need people in your corner. You need time.
Yes.
You need all of that. Anthony, you have some kids and some grandkids. Is that right?
Yes. I have a son and four grandchildren.
And your son, Tyrone?
Anthony Wright Jr.
Anthony Wright Jr., yes. Named after you.
Yes.
What's he doing these days?
He happy dad's home.
He's happy that his dad is home. Yeah. Were you able to stay in touch with him while you were in prison?
Oh, man. He part of the reason why I survived so long in there.
Because of your son?
He gave me the energy that I need to get up every day. I mean, you know, I wasn't there, but I was there. I mean, so, or I should say, he allowed me to be there. A lot of times in our situation, when someone such as myself, the father of a boy, you're incarcerated for extended period of time. For myself, 25 years, the child tend to go the other way.
Yeah.
And everybody tend to point the finger at you. And for me, it was the opposite. People ask me all the time, what was the connection? I don't know. I don't know what I did different than any other parent would have did with their child. I just tried to stay present in his life all the time.
He's a college grad, isn't he?
Oh, man. No, he didn't finish.
But he's gone to college?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. He went to Cheney for a couple years. Took a few semesters off. Mm-hmm. Just had a baby girl. Just turned one a few months ago, Ramira.
What does she call you?
Pop, pop. Best words I ever heard.
Yeah,
I was 20 years old, 25 years ago. I was just a young kid myself, with a kid. He was 4 years old. I was 20 years old. And 25 years later, I could never imagine being somebody's grandfather. So the whole time, his fiance was carrying the baby. We was trying to figure out what the name the baby was going to call me.
Yeah.
And for sure, I said not Pop Pop or Grandpa.
That's right.
But that's what you got, right?
But to hear those words,
yeah.
I wanted to say it every time I say it. It's unbelievable. It make my heart come out of my chest to hear those words come out of my mouth.
I read some about you in preparation for the show, and I know you sent out a lot of letters to a lot of different people saying, I did not commit this crime.
Yeah. Anybody, you know, it's a saying, everybody in prison say they innocent.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in prison say they innocent. At that time, I had no voice but my own. I don't think it was reaching many earlobes. So my way of communicating, I was just sending, I had a routine. I will send 10 letters out all the time to 10.
Like every week, send out 10 letters, something like that?
To every legal, any place that had a legal facility, whether it be a college, a law firm, an office, anybody. And so many people was interested in my case, but it was way out the jurisdiction. And at the time, the Innocent Project in New York was new. And my case had a lot of DNA evidence in it.
Yeah.
And everyone that I knew and everybody that I had written to had written back and referred me to the Innocent Project over New York.
I want to pick up on that only because we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Anthony Wright. He was just exonerated by a jury this month, found not just not guilty, but that he didn't commit a crime of 25 years ago. Also with us is one of his lawyers, Rebecca Lasher. Marissa Bluestein is the legal director of the Pennsylvania Innocent Project, and Tyrone Wirtz works with Temple University's Inside Out program. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. And we'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Marissa, we were just talking during the break, and Anthony was describing what it was like to be in prison writing letters every week, trying to get someone to take up his case and someone to help him prove his innocence. 25 years is a long time.
It is a long time, but it's also not unusual. We see clients who have exactly what Tony was saying, a routine. They'll write 10 letters a week, 5 letters a week, however many they're allowed to get out. They have a very limited number of stamps they're allowed to have from the prison. It's expensive to do this, and they keep at it like it's the job. And then when they get into court, if they get an organization like ours that has the resources to be able to do the testing, the investigation, we find evidence that they're innocent, we get into court, then the courts and the prosecutors turn around and say, well, you weren't diligent. You didn't get this on your own. Why didn't you approach this witness 15 years ago? Because he could not do it. And trying to get that education into the courts is a lot of what we do in our litigation, but just that disconnect between how hard they are working and the perceived, I mean, I'm going to call it laziness from the courts, which is completely untrue. It takes a lot to kind of undo all those assumptions.
Let me turn to you, Rebecca Lasher. And Anthony, I want to get you in on this as well. And Anthony did sign a confession. It was a 7-9 page, rather detailed confession as I understand it. I will ask you, Anthony, about it. But I'm just – I think for people outside of the judicial system, they might probably would say to themselves, why would anyone sign a confession if they didn't commit this crime? Can you help us understand that?
I can. And Tony was crossed on this extensively, both when he took the stand in 1993 and then again when he took the stand now, I guess, less than 2 weeks ago in 2016. And he did sign a piece of paper, and he did sign all of the pieces of paper. But as Tony testified both times, he was never given an opportunity to see what was on that piece of paper. Did not read them. The first time he read it was in his 1993 case when he was received the copy of the statement in discovery. And one of the things that came out in this trial was how this confession was taken, was via cross-examination of the detectives, the two detectives who purported to take that confession, about errors that were in it, about the speed at which you could really write a word-for-word, what was said to be a word-for-word confession, and about the timing of how this whole statement was taken and what happened on that Sunday back in October of 1991 that really undermined what was in the statement. And one of the key issues in that statement was that Tony was supposedly told the detectives what he was wearing the night of the murder, which was a Chicago Bulls sweatshirt that was spelled Chicago Bills in the statement, a pair of blue jeans and a pair of black Fila sneakers, and that he supposedly told them that they could find those at his mother's house where he was staying. And those clothes were extensively tested for DNA, and the wearer DNA came back to the victim, Louise Talley, and there was absolutely no scientific evidence to conclude that Tony had ever worn those clothes.
And you had not read this I'll call it confession, but this piece of paper until 1993. Were you given your Miranda rights? Were you given the chance to have a phone call? I know they took you down to the police station.
Nothing. Never given.
Did you know what your rights? You were a young man. You were 20 years old. Did you know what your rights were?
No, I never thought about it back then. And you know, I was 20 years old. You know, what happened to me back then, you know, far as the interrogation, the only word that I can use for it now that everybody used, I thought I was being punked. I was waiting for somebody to come out and say,
it's a joke?
Yeah, it's a joke. You know what I mean? So, you know, they stated that they just wanted to ask me some questions and they was going to bring me right back where they got me from, which was my mother's house.
Right. And you were actually home at the time, as
yes.
I understand it.
Yes.
With a girlfriend, I
yes.
think, watching TV or
yes.
watching sports or something on TV.
Watching a football game. The football game just came on.
Did you know what you were signing when it was put in front of you?
Absolutely not. I thought if I signed the paper, they would allow me to go home.
Uh-huh.
At least that's what I was told. And at that time, that's the only thing I wanted to do was go home. Go home. They didn't have to take me back. I would have walked back that day.
If I can go back to you, Rebecca, because, I mean, it sounds like what Anthony signed was a potential death warrant for himself. I mean, if the jury hadn't been sort of split, I guess, that first time around, that could have sent him to death row.
That's right, Marty. His first case was a capital case, and the jury found him guilty and then was hung on death and voted 7-5. And so Tony received a life sentence rather than be sentenced to mm-hmm. death. But that certainly was a risk and an issue at the first trial.
So when you heard that sentence, Anthony, at your first trial, what did you think?
What does that mean? I was a 22, 23-year-old young man. I don't remember exactly what went through my head. Again, referring to my mother, the day of sentencing, I asked no member of my family to come down there.
You didn't want them there?
I didn't want them to endure the pain of what was being done to me. My mother chose to come anyway. The jury, Rebecca just mentioned the jury was hung. on death, so it automatically went to a life sentence. I just remember my mom screaming so loud, fell on the floor in a fetal position. And here I am standing a few feet in front of her, shackled, and couldn't do anything. That never leaves you.
I'm curious about his first lawyer, his representation. Do you feel, I'm back to you, Rebecca, but do you feel like he was adequately represented? Were witnesses called? Did he get the defense that he deserved?
They had very different evidence in 1993 than we had in 2016. And his attorney was Bernie Siegel, who has since passed. And he called witnesses. He did examine the police officers. A lot of the 1993 trial testimony that we had was very helpful in developing our case in 2016. I think he was faced with a very different prospect without the DNA evidence and, frankly, without some of the investigation that we were able to do in this case. We certainly didn't know the identity of Ronnie Bird, who was the source of the semen on the rape kit, and then didn't have the ability then to question witnesses on their association with Ronnie Bird and why they might have testified in the way that they did against Anthony back in 1993.
Because out of these wrongful conviction cases, Marissa, is that, of course, the guilty person, the person who actually committed the crime in this case, is out
right,
potentially committing other crimes.
That's right. I mean, of the 344 DNA exonerations recorded by the Innocence Project in New York, I think approximately 170 true perpetrators have been identified, and they've gone on to commit additional 70-some sexual assaults, 50-some murders, and other gross instances of public crime. And it's a real public safety issue. Absolutely.
Let me turn to you, Tyrone, and just in terms of – and I realize these are different cases here, but nonetheless, what it took you to begin to get your life not just on track, but where you feel like this is who I am, this is what I learned in prison, this is how I want to live my life.
Yeah. Like I said, I searched it very similar in some ways. And like, I don't like to be the poster boy for reentry because my reentry was really smooth and the transition was not as horrifying as it is for most people coming home. But, one of the things was, and I think I can speak for Anthony, that he was really engaged in terms of, fighting for his freedom. I was engaged at another level.
But you were getting some college degrees.
Yeah, I went to school, I got a college degree. And, in my capacity as president of Life's Organization at Greater Fruit Prison, I was able to meet some extraordinary people along the way. And, the good thing about that is, and just like Tony, when I made that transition home, my transition was smooth because I had enormous support from not only the people that I networked and built relationships with, but also with my family. My family came to visit me every 90 days for the whole 37 years I was incarcerated, and they were there to welcome me. And not only that, I had two jobs already waiting for me. So that really assisted in helping my transition. But, most people coming home don't have that same opportunity, the same support. And so that's why I'm so happy to see Tony out. And he has enormous support from his family and his lawyers and the Innocence Project and Cindy Zeidemer down at the Federal Reentry Court. It's just for him, I'm just so happy for him. So, but most guys coming home, it's a struggle, So, like I said, my transition was smooth because of the family support and the support from the community.
Let me just reintroduce everybody. That's Tyrone Wirtz, and he works with Temple University's Inside Out program. Been talking to us about reentry for ex-prisoners. He spent some time. In fact, he had his sentence commuted after serving, 37 years in a Pennsylvania prison at Greaterford. Marissa Bluestein, legal director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. Rebecca Leshner with the Philadelphia law firm of Schneider, Harrison, Siegel and Lewis, one of the attorneys representing Anthony Wright, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's been talking about the fact that he spent 25 years in a Pennsylvania prison for a crime he did not commit, a violent brutal crime that was committed by somebody else, proved by DNA and also some evidence that was introduced in a court recently. Two trials and a jury this month exonerated him. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Marissa, let me turn back to you, and then Anthony, I'll get you back in on the conversation. Now, some states do give people who are wrongly convicted some form of compensation. Pennsylvania does not. You are working on that. Where does that issue stand?
Right, that's right. So Pennsylvania is one of a minority number of states that do not have any compensation for those who are wrongly convicted. The irony is that Anthony, as an exoneree, even though he served 25 years in prison, will get no money from the state, no help from the state, no guidance counseling, no help with job transition, no help with housing, whereas people coming on parole who actually did commit the crime, who aren't innocent but are returning citizens, they get a lot of assistance that's available to them, not exonerees. We've had to pick up our clients at prison. I've had to pick up a client on the side of a road where she was dropped off with a garbage bag full of her belongings. So we want to change that. There is a bill that's pending right now in the Senate. It's Senate Bill 1274, which would provide for compensation for those who are wrongly convicted. There's some problems with the bill, but we certainly support the idea. And in fact, next month on October 4th, we're going to be bringing exonerees like Anthony up to Harrisburg to speak to legislators to tell them why this is so necessary for Pennsylvania.
But why a hole? I mean, why parolees get something? I mean, people that have committed a crime, served their time, and now they're out. Why do they get something and Anthony doesn't?
Because they're still under the supervision of the Department of Corrections. And that's they get the assistance. The DOC has a priority to help returning citizens get back and reenter and have productive lives. We don't have that commitment for people who are victims of wrongful convictions, of the people like Anthony. And we don't provide that any assistance to the victims of the crime themselves when there's been an exoneration. They go through all the trauma again, and that also is wrong. That's something we want to address with this legislation.
Anthony, is there something you want from the state, from the government? Marissa was talking about some changes in the law. Is there something you want?
I'll refer that question
to your lawyer, to your attorney.
Yeah, to my attorney.
You can do that. Yes, go ahead.
The better question might be to talk to Tony just about what the past week has been as far as access to resources. And while
fair enough,
it's true that we don't have formal access to a lot of state services, one of the benefits of working with the Innocence Project is that they do have a very strong network and do have people who have donated money so that there were immediate funds. One of the first things we did after the verdict was take Tony shopping because people forget he had nothing. So he had no jeans, he had no sneakers, he had no t-shirts and even underwear, which I did not help him
select. Something that lawyers do not do, right?
That's right. But then also access to services like seeing the optometrist and the dentist and getting appointments with physicians, and we've had immense amount of help from people willing to come forward. And I think that's in large part because, you know, you started the program by asking Tony whether or not he was bitter. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's been remarkable to me from getting involved starting in 2013 in Tony's cases, he has always been very positive. He has had a positive outlook on everything. He asks about the lawyers' families and cares and remembers. One of the ironic things that came up in this case was a call that he actually had with one of the interns at the Innocence Project, in which he was talking about sports because her team happened to be the Chicago Bulls because she was from Chicago. And you heard Tony talking about his team, the Sixers. And I think
I'm sorry to hear that, but no, that's yes. Okay.
And he was expressing some frustration with the team.
Yes, don't we all?
But, you know, he has these relationships where he really cares, and he has always had that very positive outlook that's continued to today.
Yes. Yes. You want to add to that, Anthony? I mean, what I hear from everybody, how important that is. Do you want to add to that? Your lawyer did a good job, I have to say.
No, she was great. What do you want me to?
Well, I'm just thinking, I mean, you have a lot of people who support you now.
Man, it's, again, you know, being gone so long, I didn't want to take myself faster than I needed to go. I never processed, my mind never processed to look this far.
Yeah.
meaning coming out, not knowing the reception from the people. The people has been unbelievable everywhere we go, in the streets, in a restaurant, no matter where we... A guy followed me all the way to the bathroom the other day in a restaurant just to shake my hand and take a selfie. So it's been great. My attorneys, Rebecca and Sam, introduced me to some people that also run a reentry program from the federal courthouse down 6th and Market. And that staff there has been unbelievable, just walking in there and these guys, Rebecca and Sam, introducing them to me. They have extended themselves in a way, way beyond anything I can imagine. Again, everybody has been so gracious. I'm so grateful for it all. So helping me see the doctors, the eye doctor, the dentist, a whole physical, get an ID, all sorts of ID.
I'm thinking, the world has changed in the last 25 years, right?
Yeah, I don't know many people carried ID 25 years ago.
Exactly.
A lot changed in 25 years. Now you need ID to do anything. You know what I mean? So it's new to me. So lucky for me, and thanks to all these guys, I was able to get a temporary ID next week. And soon as that expired, I should have had a real thing. Birth certificate, social security card.
These are all important.
Yeah, very important.
Well, let's hold on to that thought, only because we have to take another short break. And again, that's Anthony Wright. He spent 25 years in a Pennsylvania prison for a crime he did not commit. He was exonerated by a jury this month. His second trial, a DNA evidence showing that he did not commit this brutal crime. Also with us, Rebecca Lasher, and she is one of Anthony Wright's attorneys, Marissa Bluestein, legal director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and Tyrone Wirtz with Temple University's Inside Out program. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Bunch of comments here, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join that conversation, and I'll be reading some of those comments after I give Tyrone Wirtz a chance to talk about compensation.
Yeah. I found that conversation very, very interesting because, I mean, a lot of times guys come home from prison and they kind of act like the world owed them something. And really the world don't owe them anything. But in fact, Tony is a person that lost 25 years of his life, lost his mother while he's incarcerated, and he comes home to nothing. And he was innocent. And I know the whole concept of good faith, but there was no good faith in this case. Here's a guy that was forced to sign a coerced confession. Spent 25 years, and DNA that was tested proved it was someone else. And the district attorney decided to take him back to trial again, even in the face of all the evidence. There was no good faith. And so here's a man that lost 25 years of his life who certainly should be compensated for that the loss of those years.
Let me just pick up on that, because the conviction was thrown out in 2014. Is that right?
That's right.
And the DA decided to retry the case.
That's correct.
Believing that he was in some way implicated in this crime.
You'd have to ask the DA.
I mean,
I'm
asking obviously the
presumably,
wrong person here.
Presumably, yes, because they decided to retry the case. But one of the things that was frustrating here was the standard for entitlement to a new trial was clearly met, and the district attorney's office here waited until literally the eve of the PCRA hearing, the Friday before. The hearing was to begin on Monday in September of 2014, to concede that he was at least entitled to a new trial based on this newly available evidence that would have changed the jury's minds, and then proceeded to retry him. And we did have a number of meetings where we tried to persuade the district attorney's office not to take this case forward because this was not a case that should be retried. We were unsuccessful there, and thankfully we're successful in the courtroom.
Let me read some comments here. What are Anthony's dreams for his life after he went to prison? What are your goals for your life now? Are you thinking that far ahead? Is it a day-by-day kind of thing?
I can't think that far
ahead. Yeah, I understand.
My mind won't allow me to think that. that far ahead. I'm overwhelmed. Just the eighth day, I'm still processing. I'm not behind that wall any longer.
Yeah.
Looking out that window, so.
And I wonder to you, Tyrone, whether that makes sense, which is just don't get ahead of yourself.
Right. I mean, that makes a whole lot of sense, and that's the beautiful thing, because we were kind of like in the same boat. When I came home, I didn't want to move too fast. I was in a halfway house. It kind of slowed things down for me. I didn't want to think too far ahead, and I just wanted to live my day by day and get used to this whole new experience. It's like going to a new city, a new planet or whatever. So, I mean, he's doing the right thing. He's taking things very, very slow before he decides where he's going to jump in.
Let me read a Twitter question. This is from Hugh Cullen. He says, why can't the police prosecutor be held personally liable and charged with a criminal, with a crime? Excuse me. We need a federal law to guarantee federal compensation billed to the state when the state refuses to take responsibility. Marissa, you want to take that?
Well, there is a federal compensation bill, but for people who are prosecuted by the federal government. I mean, they don't have the role in terms of the state. So the question is, why is it so difficult? There's an extraordinarily high burden to prove misconduct in civil cases. Prosecutors have absolute immunity from being sued. Police, you have to meet an extraordinarily high burden in order to pierce their immunity. Civil suits take years to develop, and that's assuming that you can even survive in the courts. So it is not a fair compensation system. It is a haphazard at best. It's certainly not an equal system, and which is why we need the legislation to make it more even and compensate all those who are entitled.
An email from Kate, I think from Morristown, says they stole this man's life, and that is not right. Just for you, Anthony. Let me get some callers, and we've got Leslie from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Leslie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have a question for the lawyers and for Anthony.
Sure.
I'm an attorney, but I've never done criminal work, and I've been following the Innocence Project for years. My question is, for all those years that Anthony was incarcerated, he didn't contribute to Social Security. Will he get those benefits when he retires, if he needs them, because they didn't give him the opportunity to contribute?
Leslie, it's a good question, and my two lawyers are nodding their head. Rebecca Lasher, go ahead.
This is actually one that Marissa is spending more time on the policy end, but the answer to your question, Leslie, is unfortunately you're right. Has no Social Security benefits. He hasn't been contributing, and there's no compensation whatsoever for that.
It's not a very active 401k plan when you're inside
prison.
Right. I would say not.
19 cents an hour.
It's a disgrace. I mean, you have men who have the prime of their working lives taken away from them. They can't contribute. They're unable to contribute, and so they have nothing to be able to support their retirement when they get out. Our client, Louis Fogel, was in for 34 years. He has no Social Security, zero, and yet he's supposed to help himself and survive.
Anthony, did you have jobs? Did you work when you were in prison?
Yes, a number of them.
And I heard you both say 19 cents an hour?
19 cents an hour. Yeah. 19 cents an hour. Yeah.
Let me get, I think it looks like we have Dan from King of Prussia joining us on Radio Times. And Dan, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
First of all, Mr. Wright, God bless you and best of luck as you move forward.
Thank you.
I'm a trial attorney myself, although on the civil side. And we attorneys take a lot of hits, most of them self-inflicted. But I can tell you this story, and I followed it closely, makes me proud to be an attorney. And, Rebecca, I give you a lot of credit for you and your team getting involved the way that you did. And just finally, and I think you may have answered this previously, it just is very bewildering to me as to how this case was prosecuted a second time with the DNA evidence falling through the way that it did. I wonder if you could just comment a little bit more about any non-confidential discussions you had with the DA about just letting this thing go.
Yeah, all good questions, Dan. I appreciate the call. And Rebecca, anything you want to say in response to that?
Well, first, thank you. we were very proud to be a part of the case. All I'm really willing to say as far as our contact with the district attorney is that we did meet with the district attorney himself, and we also met with the head of homicide early in this case, and we laid out our entire case. We were not quiet about what our defenses would be, and not just as far as the DNA, but what the DNA did to undermine the statement, what the DNA did to undermine the testimony of witnesses who are no longer available because of death. Mm-hmm. And one of the disappointing things that came out of this trial was there really was not a response to the DNA.
Is DNA, Marissa, is that incontrovertible? I mean, if you, especially in a case like this, and this was, there was semen that was found, and also some question, I guess, about clothing and what was on the clothing. Mm. When you have that kind of information, that kind of evidence, is it the, I don't want to say smoking gun, but is it incontrovertible?
In most cases, yes. I mean, I think our board president, David Richmond, just did an analysis, and I think he found that 98% of cases where DNA becomes available, there is no retrial. You're talking about a tiny, tiny number of cases that go to retrial. Mm-hmm. Because in this case, it wasn't just incontrovertible. It was supported by both sides. The Philadelphia Police Department's own laboratory confirmed the results and conducted further testing, which further establishes mm-hmm. his innocence.
Anthony, it's your first trial. Were you often offered a plea bargain? Did your attorney say, let's bargain this down and get some lesser, try to get some lesser sentence?
Yes.
And what did you say? Well, why didn't you do that?
Absolutely not. The offer was to plead to a life sentence instead of going to trial and losing and facing a death sentence.
And you said no way.
Absolutely not.
Right. Did you want to add to that, Rebecca?
Well, I think just to clarify, Tony's talking about, I believe, the 1993
the first
trial.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, the first trial. And that's because you knew you didn't commit this crime, right?
I was absolutely innocent. Yeah. Didn't commit the crime. Didn't know nothing about the crime. Didn't know anyone that participated in the crime. Absolutely had nothing to do with that.
No connection
whatsoever. Yes.
And you had an alibi, as I understand.
Yes.
And you had witnesses.
Yes.
Yes. Maybe yes, maybe no.
This really was more of a forced statement mm-hmm. case than it was an alibi case. Tony did testify, and again testified in 2016 about who he was with that night. But as far as the district attorney's timing goes, he was out later that night.
So some of those details. I hear you. Let me read a Twitter comment from Rob Benjamin. Pennsylvania, Delaware have no law to compensate the wrongfully convicted. New Jersey's statute can exclude coerced pleas or false confessions. We need a federal law. This is the second comment we've gotten, mm-hmm. Marissa, saying we need not just a state-by-state laws, but we need a federal law.
Well, we do support that. There are jurisdictional issues, which is why the federal government can't necessarily get involved because they didn't prosecute the case. But mm-hmm. we do agree, certainly, that there should be uniformity throughout the states and throughout right. all the compensation laws that are. The Innocence Project in New York has a series of best practices in terms of providing compensation, which we fully endorse. And we do think that those should be the norm throughout all the states.
Did you want to add to that? Yep.
Just jumping in to support Marissa's efforts at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project here, too, as far as we're talking about the compensation for confessions, but one of the things that has really been pushed at the policy level is also how statements are taken now, and a push for best practices as far as taking confessions, which includes recording. And obviously this one was not recorded, and that's something that was emphasized
right,
too
right.
at this trial.
No video recording, no audio recording.
That's no, right.
not whatever happened in this room.
Despite availability.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Let me read some more comments here. Facebook comment from Eliza Morrison. God bless you, Tony.
Thank you.
A lot of people are weighing in on this. A caller from Aston says, why aren't there more programs like education and skill training? And Tyrone, perhaps I can put that to you in terms of, you know, again, the kinds of skills and support that people need once they're released from prison.
Yeah, there are some programs in it. But, you know, what's interesting about Pennsylvania is they exclude lifers, people who are sentenced to life in prison, to participate in a lot of the educational growth programs because they see that you serve in life, you're not getting out, you're going to die in prison, so why waste resources on you? But the fact of the matter is, here's a guy that could have. And Tony, I know Tony, we was in Greatford together. Uh-huh. He was always an energetic guy. He kept focused on what he needed to do. But there are the system is really lacking in helping those people make that transition. Now, there are some pretty good programs out there like RISE, what's going on down at Sixth and Market, Gateways to Reentry to help people make that transition, because the state, as Marissa said, offers some a modicum of support. But, you know, when you spend 20, 25, 30, 35 years in prison, I mean, you've been gone for so long. It's like being captured in what that. Well,
like a gulag.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
something.
Yeah. Right, right. And now you're transitioning, and so I mean, there is so much support that's needed to help one make that transition. I'm so happy for Anthony that he has the help of the Innocence Project and his lawyers and his family. That is huge in terms of just psychologically, because I don't think people really understand what that really means.
How many other Anthony Wrights do you think there are, Marissa Bluestein?
Well, we know. Through the National Exoneration Registry, there are 58 Pennsylvanians who have been exonerated, just like Tony. We know that there are additional 5 people who were exonerated through the federal system. How many others are out there? We'll never know. There's no way to kind of keep an accurate assessment, but we estimate anywhere between 3-4% of convicted individuals are in fact innocent, and that's generally felonies. Well, that's not even counting small misdemeanors in terms where people just plead in order to get out of prison, as happens quite frequently. So this is only – we're talking about the serious felony issues. And of those, DNA evidence is only available in maybe 12-13% of those. The vast majority, DNA will never be the helpful – that it, as helpful as it was for Tony. We have to rely on other types of evidence, even though the foundation of the conviction may be just as weak. But to undo it takes even more effort and more time and more effort.
And it's more so because, as Tony said earlier, that there's a belief that everybody in prison say they're innocent. So when the truly innocent clamor to say that I'm innocent, it's really hard to break through all that noise. And I am just so thrilled that Tony stayed focused and stayed diligent about sending letters out that really make people stop and take a look. And I really got to acknowledge Ms. Bluestein for the great work she does down at the Innocence Project to help people along.
You know, Rebecca, I'm curious about what did you learn from this case, from working with Anthony Wright?
So much. That's a tough question. I think most of all, what I've learned and what I am most grateful for is the relationship that I have with Tony, and again, his ability to stay positive and what a difference that made in seeing this case through to the end. The courage that he had to take the stand in this case was remarkable under a difficult cross-examination. His staying true to his legal team, too, to push us to keep moving forward. And we had a number of hurdles in this case. And the latest was the district attorney claiming to find new evidence that had to be tested in February. And so Tony had waited all this time, had his convictions vacated in September of 2014, and trial was scheduled for February of 2016 and then had to be pushed to August of 2016, and, stayed the course. And just to see him walk out was
what
will probably be the highlight of my legal career.
Oh, that's great. And we're almost out of time, Anthony. I saw a picture in the paper of the jury forewoman giving you a great big hug.
Yeah.
I mean, the jury, they exonerated you.
Yeah. I turned 45 years old Monday. Outside of my family, I've never met a woman quite like her. And it's so funny you just mentioned that. Just a couple of days ago, I believe it was Monday.
And I hate to do this to you only because we're almost out of time here.
Okay.
This was on his birthday, though. And we happened to run into Grace Greco, the foreperson, on the streets of Philadelphia, which just shows you how wonderful it is to be in Philadelphia.
Wow. Yes.
There you go.
Wow.
Well, Anthony, it's been such a pleasure to meet you, and I thank you for all the hard work that you did in getting yourself out of prison.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Anthony Wright, Rebecca Lasher, Marissa Bluestein, and Tyrone Wirtz, our guests in this hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us.